Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I've never felt like this before. It's like you just get me. I feel like my true self with you. Does that sound crazy? And it doesn't hurt that you're gorgeous. Okay, that's it. I'm taking you home with me. I mean, you can't find shoes this good just anywhere. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Barry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Barry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
In hindsight, when I was looking for my next opportunity after Colgate, I knew I wanted to come back to the Philadelphia area, and I interviewed at a few other schools, but when I went to Swarthmore, it was like I'd found my people. It just felt right. It felt like home. And I was like, okay, there is, you know, and it just happened to be high academic, but I think that's why I felt that way. We got each other.
And our guest this week is Melissa Finley. She is the head softball coach at Division III Swarthmore College, one of the best programs in the area. And Melissa, thanks so much for coming in studio.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So as we are recording this, end of September, what's life like? Is this a busy time? Obviously, your main season is in the spring, but I think anyone that follows any kind of college sports knows it's basically kind of a 12-month-a-year thing. So what's the focus right now?
So right now we are gearing up for our fall season. We have our fall play date this Saturday. So the team's been practicing for a few weeks. So it's busy with that, getting everybody kind of acclimated, welcoming the new first years, as well as recruiting. It's a busy recruiting time. We're trying to wrap up our senior class. So we'll be out on the road watching some games this upcoming weekends.
Is this an enjoyable time, or is it more of a box checking, making sure the table's set for the season?
I find it really enjoyable. I think that's why I'm also in coaching, because I find all different parts of the year fun. I think getting to know a new group and figuring out what our team culture is going to be like and the different personalities, how they're going to work well together, how are we fitting the puzzle pieces together? You know, that's the fun part of the job for sure.
When did you first start playing softball? Because you grew up in Canada, correct?
I did, yes. I started playing probably when I was about 10 years old. I started with soccer first, but I was the one out there picking the flowers and sitting in the grass. It wasn't really my sport, so my parents switched it up pretty quickly on me. So yeah, started with T-ball and then fast pitch, as it's called in Canada, around age 10.
Did I guess softball resonated with you more than soccer did, safe to say?
Yes. Yeah. And I became a pitcher because basically my dad told me I wasn't good enough to be a pitcher. So then I was that kid that went out in the backyard and practiced every day to prove him wrong. And then that happened to stick. So
what was it about the sport that, other than wanting to prove that point, like the sport itself, because that's only going to go so far. So what was it about the sport that you fell in love with?
That's a great question. I think I liked the pressure aspect of it, of like everybody's kind of watching you and it's a make or break situation, especially as a pitcher when you're up to bat hitting. But then there's also the team element. So I think you have that like individual success and work ethic that you have to figure it out. But then, you know, if you don't get it done, then you can rely on your teammates to also do that. And then the fun aspect of having your teammates around too. But yeah, I also think maybe there was less running involved. So that also helped, that, you know, practice wasn't just let's go run around a lot. So that kept it entertaining for me.
So when growing up, does the idea of really enjoying it start to marry with the idea that I'm pretty good at this? Do you remember?
I think I was in high school by that point, and me and my dad, we've always had a great relationship around sports, and he was my coach growing up. But I hit a certain point where he said that he thought I was developing beyond what his capabilities were as a coach. And we decided to drive 2 hours one way to play for a team out of Toronto. And that's kind of when I was like, oh, okay, like, we're really committing to this. I'm committing to this. And I knew I wanted to play the best competition there was and find a way to see how good I really could be.
And I guess at no point did it feel like something you had to do. It was always something you wanted to do, even with all that baked in, the drive and stuff like that.
Correct. Yeah. Of course, there were tough days, or, you know, I was in high school at the time, so I remember getting home late and having a test the next day or things like that. But I actually think that prepared me well for college. And, you know, I was always the one driving it. My dad would never have forced me to do it because he was also the one driving me and doing all those things as well, too. So
now you ended up going to college at Princeton. Was a goal to come to the States to play, or was it just as opportunities arose, that was the path that was most attractive to you?
The goal was to play in the States. Growing up in Canada playing sports, if you were good, at least in my age, you know, that's what really good athletes went and did, because there just wasn't the collegiate athletic system in Canada. There maybe was a little bit around hockey, but even then it was, you know, it's more of a club sport scene where you do play other schools, but, you know, there's no scholarships attached or anything like that. So again, it was, yeah, what, you know, where am I going to go to school? But there was no formal recruiting process like there is, well, especially not these days, but even just coming from Canada, you know, you don't really know what to do. You just go play in a few tournaments and hope somebody sees you. And yeah, I was fortunate enough that not only was I able to be seen at a tournament in Florida, but the head coach at the time was Canadian also. So she was given kind of a heads up to take a look at me.
Were there other schools you were looking at, or kind of with that connection, everything, like once Princeton kind of came into the picture, that was the direction you were going to go?
I was looking at other schools. I did have other offers, but none that were even remotely close academically to Princeton. And yeah, once Princeton entered the stage, I had to take that opportunity.
What'd you study at Princeton?
Economics.
Okay. So you come to another country to start college. How's the transition? Because, I mean, I would imagine you're taking a big step up competition-wise, really far from home. You know, what's that transition like when you start playing college softball?
It was intimidating for sure. Not only in terms of like the softball piece of like, am I good enough, trying to answer that question, but the I felt like I was the dumbest person on Princeton's campus. So, you know, and I realize now that I was not the only one probably feeling that way. But it was kind of like, okay, just keep going one day at a time. And thankfully, I didn't get as much of the homesick feeling as I would have maybe anticipated. I think you stay busy enough. I was also an independent person in general. I think traveling to play softball in high school helped prepare me for that as well. And I've always relied on my work ethic. So I knew even if I was behind in something, if I worked hard enough at it, especially in the softball skill set wise, that I would catch up. And that, you know, I was at least confident enough that if I decided to do something and be great at it, that I could get there.
Was there anything from a coming from a different country standpoint that not even was challenging, but just like you had to kind of get used to, like something that was focused on or something that's really important here that just isn't part of things in Canada? And I don't mean just softball. I just mean life in general. Was there anything like, why are you guys doing that?
That's a great question. And it's been quite a few years now. So there wasn't anything that really stood out. I remember getting made fun of a lot for my accent, for saying A a lot. but to be honest, it was actually an easier transition than I anticipated. And I think it also helped that I was going to a school where everybody comes from different places. So I wasn't the only one feeling a little bit outside of my element. You know, I think if I had gone to like a state school where everybody was from that area, I would have felt more out of place.
Now, along with playing at Princeton, you also played for the Canadian national team. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
How did you get involved with that? Is that something where, you know, you were excelling obviously in high school and playing at that age and you tried out, or they came to you? How'd that work?
So they do open tryouts every year. And there was one year where I was planning on trying out and I injured myself. It was freshman year at Princeton, and we made it to regionals and I had a pretty good year, but I was planning on trying out for the Canadian team. So I went and tried out, but I knew I wasn't 100% because my ankle. So it was kind of one of those things where I know I got on their radar because I did well enough that they wanted to keep an eye on me, but they couldn't have me play that summer with my injury. And then the following year I got an invitation to try out. Had a really good year my sophomore year at Princeton, and they had me play in a couple tournaments in like the junior national team that summer. And then it was kind of like, you know, I played the next couple of years, and then kind of once you're in the system, they keep an eye on you, track you, see how you're doing in college. And, you know, it was an interesting time because they were also gearing up for the Olympics, you know, and that always brings a lot more bodies, a lot more competition to the stage.
And you ended up winning, I think I've got here, a silver in the Pan Am Games. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yep.
In 2003?
Yep.
Were you in play for the Olympic team in 2004?
I was very much on the bubble, on the periphery. I think if I wasn't in college and I could commit full time to training, I think I would have had an opportunity to at least compete for that spot. They were asking anybody who was kind of in my position to centralize starting in January to train and try out with no guarantee of making the team. And at the time I was heading into my senior year, and I decided not to do that because, again, I think I would have been torn in two different directions. And not able to fully invest. So, you know, that's one of those things that I'm like, I think that might be a regret of mine looking back, because I thought in my head, you're young, I can do it in the next 4 years, right? I'll commit to that then. I don't need to do it now. But yeah, in hindsight, that may have been the most in shape I've ever been in my life. So that might have been one of the best opportunities to do it. But at the same time, I don't regret graduating in 4 years and having that experience as well.
The level of softball at college at that time and the level internationally, comparable? I mean, I would imagine international is probably better, but was it relatively close or was it a big gap?
The big gap was between the top 3 to 5 countries and then the rest, right? So if we were playing, you know, Japan, a U.S., Australia, Mexico, that's really tough competition. And that's where you're facing the best from every country, right? Where it's, you know, you have to be excellent at all of your skills. But then, you know, we would play a Bahamas or a, you know, I don't want to put down other countries or anything like that, but, you know, they just weren't as developed. They're not developing the sport as much. So that would be lower competition than I would see in college. But at the same time, you know, I think growing the game has grown tremendously since 20 years ago. And the ability to just have more competition, I think, especially in Europe, the game is growing a lot. South America, the game is growing a lot. And, you know, I think you kind of see that as the competition grows for the Olympic year. And everybody's kind of fighting for that. Those, you know, I think it was only 6 spots the past Olympics to try and earn that spot.
You pitched, but you also were very good at the plate. Internationally, did you do both, or were you just focused on pitching?
I did not pitch internationally.
You did not pitch internationally?
I was an outfielder for that.
Which do you take more pride in, your success as a pitcher or your success as a hitter? Because, I mean, you won a ton of games at Princeton. You have all kinds of home run records, stuff like that. But if you were pitching somebody on your career in the elevator, would you mention the pitching first or the hitting first?
Hitting, absolutely. I love hitting. I could hit all day. Even now, like at practice, you know, the team makes fun of me that I don't hit the ball as far as I used to. But I enjoy hitting. It to me, that was the fun of the whole game. And I always kind of relied on my hitting. If I messed up pitching wise, I could just step in there and make up for it. So
what's the key to being a good power hitter in softball?
It's funny because, you know, as a coach, you talk to your players about this. I think the key to being a good hitter is swinging at the right pitch on time, swinging at strikes. But, you know, I think it's knowing your swing, being confident when you're swinging, and, you know, not, I could get into the details, but really it's if you step in there and you believe you're going to hit the ball over the fence, like you at least give yourself a chance. And I believe that every single time I step into the batter's box.
And when it comes to pitching, what is the key to success? Is it, I'm sure it's a combination of these things, speed, location, mixing speed, stuff like that. But if you had to put at the top, what is the most important thing if you're going to excel pitching at a high level? What is like the number one thing you have to address and make sure you're doing consistently?
Change of speeds. That's the number one thing when I'm out recruiting. You have to have a changeup because it's a hard pitch to develop if you haven't developed it already. And I think, at the high level, no matter how good you are, no matter how great your location control is or even your spins, if you're not able to, you know, mix up that speed or that timing, you know, really good hitters are going to at least find a way to put a barrel on a ball.
How much did being able to excel at a high level in both areas kind of help each area? Like your success as a pitcher, I would imagine you could dig into that as a hitter and say, well, this is what they did to get me out, so this is what I would do in that situation. And vice versa. You know, do they complement each other from a mindset standpoint that you can kind of dig in and kind of think how the person you're opposing, be it a hitter or a pitcher, is thinking?
Yeah, that's another great question, because I think at the same time, I would always have to be careful that I wouldn't try and guess, right? Because if I, you know, it can only go so far, because at the end of the day, I'm not them. I'm not, you know, I don't know their game plan. But if I was like, okay, yeah, I would definitely throw myself this in this situation. Sometimes I would, you know, cross myself up. So I had to learn to almost keep them separate. And, you know, when I'm in the box hitting, I'm just reacting. I'm just seeing the ball, hitting the ball. You know, you can't overthink in those scenarios. Same thing with pitching. It always came down to trusting myself, trusting my stuff, and that my best pitch or my best swing was always going to beat whatever the other person was trying to do.
Now, you were Ivy League Player of the Year in 2003?
Correct.
At what point could you start to see that other teams were paying a lot of attention to you, be it the way they approached you, getting harder to find, get pitches to hit because they just rather almost, if not intentionally, walk you, just not bother with you? You know, was there a tangible moment in your college career when it suddenly became clear that word was out and there were some teams that probably weren't going to let you be the one to beat them?
Yeah, it was definitely partway through that 2003 year where I was not getting very many pitches to hit, especially in close games, especially with people on base. And that continued throughout you know, the rest of my career. And I really had to, I almost changed how I practiced, where every time I practiced, I had to make sure that I was working on my pitch selection and not chasing out of the zone, and that, you know, it was okay to take walks, right? Because as a hitter, you want to hit. And so, and I was always an aggressive hitter. But yeah, I had to learn that chasing, you know, chasing pitches wasn't in my best interest.
And being an aggressive hitter, how difficult a lesson, I don't want to say to learn, because you obviously understood it, but you're kind of going against like the core of who you are as a player. And a lot of times I think that's easier said than done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's, you know, maybe part of the reason why too, my year after, you come in with all these expectations, like, you know, my whole career, you build, you get better. And then I was like, well, how am I going to beat that, right? How can I be better than that? And then you try and force it, and you are swinging at stuff. You're like, okay, like, I just got to get on a roll. And so that year was probably my most challenging year individually as a player, just trying to find that balance, yeah, between being aggressive, waiting on pitches, and you know, just, again, trusting that, like, I can still be maybe a, you know, 350 hitter, still really good, even if that's not a, you know, 400 hitter.
What's some of your favorite memories from your playing career?
I remember we won, when we won the championship, the Ivy League championship, my freshman year. That will probably be one of the greatest memories that I've had, because it had been, the senior class hadn't won yet. And it was a really long time that Princeton historically has done really well in the Ivy League. So for them to not have won a championship was pretty rare. And that was, you know, it was our goal, and we set out to do it. And I played a pretty big part in it, which made me feel really, helped my ego, I guess, or helped my confidence levels. And then another one was, we went out to California for spring break, and we played Stanford, and we had no business beating them. But to this day, me and my friends will still be like, remember that time we beat Stanford? So that was a pretty cool memory also.
We need to take a break on One-on-One. We will have more with Swarthmore College head softball coach Melissa Finley in just a few moments. But right now, there's nothing quite like the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid when it comes to exhilarating efficiency. With hybrid technology and thrilling capability, these vehicles deliver an electrifying performance on every drive. Discover for yourself what truly makes these hybrids special. Redefine your driving experience with Honda. KBB.com's Best Value Brand of 2023. Contact your local Honda dealer today about the Honda Accord Hybrid and the CR-V Hybrid. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, we return to our conversation with Division III Swarthmore College head softball coach Melissa Finley.
Did you always figure you were going to coach?
No.
So what? No. What opens the door to that, or when does that enter the thought process of a possibility?
So I actually, after graduation, because I was an econ major, and I was kind of at that point in my life where I was like, you know what, like, now I have to be an adult. I'm going to enter the workforce, and softball will just be, you know, maybe slow pitch on the weekends here, there. And I went into finance back in Canada for 2 years, and I hit a hit a wall where I was like, I don't want this to be the rest of my life. I miss the competition and I miss sports. And I think there's something there. And I would help out, you know, coaching locally and with some youth teams. But to be honest, dealing with the parents at that level was not enjoyable. And, you know, so I thought about it and I reached out to my coach, my collegiate coach at the time, and, you know, asked for her advice and help, because part of the issue was I was Canadian. So I also needed support in order to come back and coach here. And thankfully, I was able to get a great opportunity at Penn to do that. And I said, even if this isn't long term, maybe I can take classes or, you know, get my master's or something like that, so that, you know, if I want it, if it doesn't work out, I have a backup plan. But then after, 2 years here, I knew it was just a much different feeling getting up and going to work and actually enjoying what I was doing, as opposed to, you know, what I was doing in finance.
Yeah, that was kind of my next question. Was it more the missing softball or the lack of fulfillment from that job? I would sound like probably a combination of the two kind of come together.
Correct. Yeah.
So, before we talk about coaching, you're a star player at Princeton, and now you're coaching at Penn. Anyone who knows anything about the Ivy League knows that these are heated rivals regardless of the sport. It's very intense. Was it a difficult transition for you to get used to wearing a different P and to now look at Princeton as the other, to look at Princeton as the competition? Was it tough?
I would always say at that time, my heart was with Princeton and it always would be until we played against them. So like every other game, every other thing, that's fine. But until we play against them, and even then, it's not like I don't want you to do well. It's just it's my professional responsibility to be the best that I can be in this role at this time. I think it did help that my college coach was no longer there, so I wasn't necessarily coaching against her. But, you know, I think just having to wear different hats. There was times when I was able to compartmentalize, and I think sports helped with that, that, you know, I was a fan on this day, but on this day I'm a coach. And those are two different hats that I'm wearing. But yeah, it was interesting. It was more, I would say, interesting to some of the players who had played against me, to then now I'm their coach. And, you know, I almost had to prove to them that, like, I was on their side. I was there to help them and build that trust early on and quickly, you know, so that it wasn't like, you know, even just being a young coach, you have to prove yourself. So I had that extra element.
What was the biggest lesson you had to learn about being a coach those first few years?
That not everybody is me. That I, obviously, I love softball to the point where I do it as a career. And when you're talking about Ivy League athletes or even, you know, Swarthmore athletes, they have other interests and things that they want to go into their life and do, and that not everybody, like, they care about softball, but it's on a whole different level than what I cared about it, right? So learning how to come to terms with that and not be frustrated that maybe they're not working as hard as I would work in that scenario, and figure out what does make them tick and kind of individualize the coaching experience. I think that was the toughest part of, like, well, why aren't they in here doing extra reps? Like, I was doing that. And, you know, so, yeah, just figuring out that everybody has a different motivation for why they might be playing, and that, you know, they might want to have those extra reps or do that extra stuff. But this other thing that they're reaching towards, maybe it's becoming a doctor or a lawyer or something like that, is also very important to them.
Going along with that, how tough was it? Because as someone who played at a high level, who played at the international level, who could have made a run at an Olympic team, I would imagine, and I asked this of a lot of coaches, there were certain things that just kind of came easy to you that were almost reflexive within the game that not everyone can do. Was it a lesson you had to learn that maybe this kid just doesn't have the ability to do something and you have to have the patience to kind of understand that, or were you pretty good with that?
I think it was a lesson that I had to learn. And I think as I've gone along in my coaching career, I've figured it out quicker with certain athletes that's what's going on. But I think it did also help when I played, especially at a place like Princeton, where I was kind of put in a leadership role pretty early on, that, you know, I kind of figured that part out too, when I was like helping my teammates and be like, oh, you, like, yeah, you don't think the same way, or you're not, I'm telling you to do this and it's just not translating. Now, as a coach, right, you also want to try different ways to help them either feel it or change it or do that. But yeah, sometimes it's one of those things where their strength is not your strength. And figuring out, I think what I've been able to do is figure out, okay, if this athlete isn't able to quite make that adjustment, what is it that they're really good at? And how do I maximize that? Because every athlete on the team, right, has something to give. And so kind of focusing on that rather than focusing on this one thing that they maybe are never going to be able to do or can't quite figure out.
Any doubts about coaching through those early years, or were you always, yes, this is it?
I think as a young person, I was always doubting, right? What am I doing with my life? Yeah, you know, I'm eating a lot of peanut butter sandwiches because, you know, you don't get into coaching for the money. And it's also, you don't really realize it at the time, but being an assistant coach where it's somebody else's program that you're there, you know, helping with is great. But I think I'm getting much more joy and fulfillment out of being a head coach because now it is my program. Now, it's almost like you're running your own business to a certain extent. And so that, yeah, I think I had doubts, but never about like the athletes or the actual coaching side of it. It was more just like, am I really sure that this is what I want to be doing?
So you're at Penn, and then you eventually get the head coaching job at Colgate.
Mm-hmm.
What's the road there, and was it overwhelming at first to become the head coach at a Division I program?
No, it was pretty seamless. I think the overwhelming part at Colgate and the unique thing about Colgate was I was the fourth coach in 4 years to come through that. So they wanted some stability. But the bigger issue was like when I got there and I'm, you know, going over like, you know, what are my standards? What's this? What's that? And, you know, they would just forget because they'd be like, well, wait, did you say this or did this other coach say this or was this the other coach? You know, and so having to be really, really, it almost helped me be really, really consistent early on and communicate. Over-communicate, you know, my expectations and what needed to happen. So I think going into that scenario really did help me be a better coach quicker. But I think even, as a young head coach, I think I overcomplicated things at times and, you know, I can keep it simpler because, again, you want to do everything and, you know, working smarter, not harder is sometimes better too. But no, the toughest transition was probably dealing with scholarships because in the Ivy League, we didn't have that. But other than that, I felt ready for the role. It was a great fit in terms of another high academic institution. And that was just, it was a really fun place to coach. It was also just a really small town to live in.
You played at Princeton, so you coach at Penn, Colgate, and now Swarthmore. And the threads there is high academic institutions. Correct. Is that by design, you feel like you're most comfortable in those atmospheres, or is it just kind of the road? You know, like, has there been a point where in your career as a coach where you've like, if possible, I would like to stay in these types of universities, or is it just kind of the road that you've taken and where the opportunities have come about?
I think when I early on, it didn't matter. I would have taken whatever. And I think I really, you know, again, as a high performing athlete and you've trained your whole life and it's this work hard, go to the next step, work hard, go to the next step. It, you know, it felt like, especially around my career, okay, so I've got the job at Penn, now I'm moving the head job at Colgate. And from there, when I first took the job, I was hoping, you know, okay, do really great here, and then what's the next mid-major or next big step in the D1 world, right? It was kind of the ego piece of, okay, bigger and better is where you want to go. But, you know, in hindsight, when I was looking for my next opportunity after Colgate, I knew I wanted to come back to the Philadelphia area. And I interviewed at a few other schools, but when I went to Swarthmore, it was like I'd found my people. It just felt right. It felt like home. And I was like, okay, there is, you know, and it just happened to be high academic, but I think that's why I felt that way. I think that's why I felt like I could really make a difference and a change because we got each other, if that makes sense. So I think, while it wasn't necessarily by design, I think it ultimately, you're going to do the best when you feel the most comfortable. And that's, you know, I think that's where it ended up. But it wasn't necessarily like, this is going to be my path as a coach.
What was the pull of Philly? Just love the area?
Yeah. When I was living here working at Penn, my first year here, I was like, I don't get it. I don't like Philly. This is, why is everybody so angry all the time? why are they honking their horn at me? You know, especially, you know, a Canadian, we're all like, oh, meek and nice. We say sorry in arguments all the time. But yeah, after a year here, you just learn to love it because they as much as they get angry, they love just as hard. And, you know, especially cheering for the sports teams. And I think one of my first years here, the Phillies made a run for it. And, you know, that's when I was like, okay, like, I get it. I get it now. And figuring out, you know, where to go and the restaurants and the food scene. And So yeah, I really fell in love with the area.
So I think you came here, or came to Swarthmore in 2017. Does that sound right?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. I think spring 2018 was my first coaching year.
Going from head coach at Division One to head coach at Division Three, I don't want to say easier because you're still the head coach of a program. How is it different? Are we dealing with the scholarship now? You're back to not having to deal specifically with scholarships?
Yeah, not having to deal with scholarship. I think as a human being, there's more balance. So, you know, I think I would count, I would have less than 10 days off a year in that level, whereas now I have every Sunday off if I want to take it. So it's just, yeah, having a more balanced human being lifestyle. It's challenging in a way that I don't have, you know, full-time assistant coaching, and I haven't since I've been here. So I'm doing everything, whereas at least at Colgate, I could delegate some responsibilities to an assistant coach. But with that said, it's different, but the same. Because at the end of the day, you don't care any less. You don't care any differently. You're still planning practices. You're still prepping scouting reports and preparing the team to play and recruiting. And so it's the same. But I will say, yeah, the balance of the lifestyle and also the pressure. It's almost kind of nice because my job there, while I love winning and I'm a competitor and I want to win, it's not like I have to win in order to keep my job. Or it's not like I have to win to say that I'm a successful coach. Because of my makeup, that's what I'm going to do. But yeah, I think at the D1 level, you have that pressure. Whereas here, it's more about their overall experience, you know, and am I creating an environment that, you know, they want to be a part of. And so that just not having that pressure, not coaching from that place and being able to coach them as human beings first and not as a business also just, yeah, adds to the fulfillment piece as well.
All that being said, you do win a lot at Swarthmore. I think you basically win 2 out of 3 games over your career as a head coach. Why? What works with this program that's allowed you to have success, not just winning, but getting to, you know, NCAA regional, winning a conference title, like stuff like that? What are some of the keys to your success, you think?
Oh, that's a great question. Because it's one of those things where, like, when it's happening, it seems so easy. But I know it's not. I know it's by design. I think, first and foremost, it comes from recruiting. I think, you know, it's hard to recruit at a place like Swarthmore, but it's also easy because people want that education. So it starts from that piece of I work really, really hard on the recruiting piece, but not only looking at talent, but the right fit for my program. I want people that I want to spend every day with, and I really try and avoid any bringing in people that might have, you know, a little too much ego or just that could be problems, basically. And thankfully, I've been getting it right in that regard. And then I think I have a really great staff behind me, and we do a great job coaching them when they're here. So I try and bring in athletes, and then how do we kind of keep them getting better while they're here? And they're, like you mentioned earlier, they're capable of it because I'm recruiting athletes. And then I think the other piece is the team culture piece, where we do spend a lot of time on, you know, how are we treating one another? How are we supporting one another? How are we making it fun? To be honest, I've had the most fun coaching this group. And I also think that they've had a lot of fun playing because I allow them to be themselves. I allow them to have fun because at the end of the day, they are working hard. And there is that balance between, it's always that question, what comes first, right? Are you winning because you're having fun, or are you having fun because you're winning? And I think you need both. And I think I think at the core, allowing them to be who they are as people and really focus on their strengths and what they do really well and how that helps the team has really kind of made for a great experience for them. And then the end result is that we win.
Do you remember when you felt like the program at Swarthmore, you really started to hit your stride? Was it early on, or did it take a couple years to where you kind of felt like, not that you were where you wanted to be and that's it, but like that, all right, this is going in the right direction, and if we work hard, this is going to be fun.
Yeah, I remember my first fall game when I first took the job, and I turned to my assistant coach and I said, what have I done? Because they were scared to even want to win or say that they wanted to win because they hadn't done it, right? And that's scary if you've never won before, to be like, yeah, no, I'm fully committed to winning. And so it took probably 2 years to change that. And I think I brought in a couple really key recruits that I remember my second year in our first team meeting, or maybe it was in the spring in February. And I said, what's our goal? And, you know, one of the seniors said something like, you know, I just hope we win more games than we lose. I was like, oh, okay, like that's not great, but okay, at least, you know, that's something. And one of my freshmen said, we're winning the championship, and like was like in it and was almost like offended that the seniors said this other thing. And I was like, that's when I was like, okay, we now have some people here who are just as invested in as I am. And how, yeah, now let's channel this. Let's work with this. And I just had to get more athletes in to support that, to be competitive. Cause I think, you know, yeah, we did some great things early on, but we were just missing a couple key pieces talent wise, that then we were able to kind of flip. But I knew 2020 or spring, season was off to such a strong start that I actually think we would have won the conference that year if it wasn't for COVID. So I think we would have at least competed that year for that conference title.
When it comes to recruiting, because you've worked at all these high-level academic institutions but at different levels, are you still kind of recruiting out of the same pools for the most part, like the same types of schools, the same types of tournaments you're going to? Or because the difference between Division I, Division III, no, but you're, the way you're nodding your head, it sounds like you are pretty much looking in the same areas as you were at Colgate, but maybe different types of kids within those teams?
Yes, I'm definitely still recruiting within the same pool because I want those kids that could maybe play D1, but maybe they want D3 for certain reasons, you know, the same reasons why I like coaching at D3. So, yeah, I want to try and pull from those pools. The downside to that is I do often lose a lot of kids to D1, either the Ivies or other schools in the Patriot League or things like that. But, you know, I want to at least try because, like I said, every now and then I do get a player that can compete at this level and does really well for us. So
kind of similar to what I asked you about your college playing career. What are, to this point, your favorite memories as the coach, specifically, let's say, at Swarthmore? Like the things that, once again, if you were pitching your career to me, what would be the first things you would that would come to mind and talk about?
It would be winning our first championship. Well, so far our only one, but I'm saying that because, you know, I'm a coach and I expect us to win again this year, but winning that championship and what we did at NCAA. So that year we had to actually finish fifth in our conference, which was below what our expectations were. It took us some time to figure out. We lost our two starting pitchers from the year before. So it took some time to kind of figure out that piece, but for whatever reason, it clicked at the right time when our backs were against the wall. And I think we went on like a 22 game win streak, and the amount of fun that that team had and the memories from that time, I don't think we'll go away for a very long time. There's a lot of meme making. You know, I remember that. I remember like they're writing songs on the bus. Like that's what you remember from times like that. Not necessarily what's happening on the fields, but you know, it was just really special to watch them take ownership of it. And they use the word joyous a lot to describe that season. So that's, you know, what we want to try and recreate every year if we can. But yeah, that was a pretty cool memory.
Does success hit differently as a coach than it did as a player?
That's a great question. No. It's the same. Yeah, for me. I think it's the same in that even as a player, I never thought like, oh, it's because of me. And as a coach, you don't get into coaching because you want the glory, right? It's kind of like when we win, it's because of them. When we lose, it's because of us. But I felt the same way as a player. And I think looking back, when you said, like, did you know you always wanted to be a coach? When I think back to my playing career, I should have known that I always wanted to be a coach because I do think I thought like a coach when I was a player.
Love to win or hate to lose?
Love to win.
Prefer practice or games as a coach?
Games, both, as a coach and a player.
How do you think you have changed as a coach from the early days as an assistant at Penn to now? And obviously different responsibilities, but I just mean lessons you've learned, way you approach things. What would you say is the biggest way you've changed?
My assistant coaches would probably say I've gotten softer. I think I've learned to care less about the little details that don't really matter to the big picture, and figuring out what those are has been a big part of it. And I would say probably once I got to Swarthmore, so maybe not necessarily new, but that every year is different. So we're going to face different adversities. We're going to face different challenges. I'm going to have to figure out a solution to some problem this year that I've never had to figure out before. And that's kind of fun, but it's also like, but I did all this other stuff every other year. You know, why last year's problem or not this year's problem? And if we're trying to fix last year's problems, then it just doesn't work that way. It's not linear that way. So that was a lesson I had to learn early on, was that just because I think I'm fixing a problem from last year, it's going to be a completely different one this year. So,
and final question, favorite part of what you do?
Watching an athlete figure something out. not only just softball wise, but when they come to me and they say, like, coach, like, I'm majoring in this, or I'm going to go to law school, or I'm, you know, kind of them figuring out not only who they are as people, but yeah, when they figure something out on the softball field that makes a big difference, that's pretty cool.
Melissa Finley, this was so much fun. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that will do it for this week's episode of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank Swarthmore College head softball coach Melissa Finley for being our guest this week. Now, if you like this show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a rating and a review. You can follow the show on X at @OneOnOnePod. You can follow me there as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah, you're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.